From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. An Invitation to the Hunt by George Hitchcock. His first impulse upon receiving it had been to throw it into the fire. They did not travel in the same social set, and he felt it presumptuous of them, on the basis of a few words exchanged in the shopping center and an occasional chance meeting on the links, to include him in their plans. Of course, he had often seen them moving behind the high iron grillwork fence that surrounded their estates, the women in pastel tea gowns serving martinis beneath the striped lawn umbrellas, and the men, suave and bronzed in dinner jackets or sailing togs. But it had always been as an outsider, almost as a peeping Tom. The most charitable interpretation, he told Emily, would be to assume that it is a case of mistaken identity. But how could it be? His wife answered, holding the envelope in her slender reddened fingers. There's only one Fred Perkins in Marine Gardens, and the house number is perfectly accurate. But there's no earthly reason for it. Why me, of all people? I should think, said Emily, helping him on with his coat and fitting the two sandwiches neatly wrapped in aluminum foil into his pocket, that you would be delighted. It's a real step upward for you. You've often enough complained of our lack of social contacts since we moved out of the city. It's fantastic, Perkins said. And of course, I'm not going. Annie ran out of the one-story shingled California ranch cottage to join the carpool, which waited for him at the curb. All the way to the city, like a dog with a troublesome bone, he worried and teased at the same seemingly insoluble problem. How had he attracted their notice? What was there in his appearance or manner which had set him apart from all the rest? There had been, of course, the day the younger ones had come in off the bay on their racing cutter, when by pure chance, as it now seemed, he had been the one man on the pier within reach of the forward mooring line. He recalled the moment with satisfaction, the tan blonde girl leaning out from the bowsprit with a coil of manila in her capable hand. "Catch!" she had cried, and at the same instant spun the looping rope toward him through the air. He had caught it deftly and snubbed it about the bit, easing the cutter's forward motion. "Thanks," she had called across the narrowing strip of blue water. But there had been no sign of recognition in her eyes, nor had she, when a moment later the yacht was securely tied to the wharf, invited him aboard or even acknowledged his continuing presence on the pier. No, that could hardly have been the moment he sought. Once at the agency, and there bedded down in a day of invoices, he tried to put the problem behind him, but it would not rest. At last, victim of a fretful, pervasive anxiety, which ultimately made concentration impossible, he left his desk and made his way to the hall telephone. Years ago, a written reproof from Henderson had left him forever scrupulous about using the agency phone for private business, where he deposited the dime and rang his golf partner, Bianchi. They met for lunch at a quiet restaurant on Maiden Lane. Bianchi was a young man recently out of law school and still impressed by the improbable glitter of society. This will give him a thrill, Perkins thought. He's a second-generation Italian, and it isn't likely that he's ever laid eyes on one of those. "The problem is," he said aloud, "that I'm not sure why they invited me. I hardly know them. At the same time, I don't want to do anything that might be construed as well as, defiance," Bianchi supplied. "Perhaps. Or call it unnecessary rudeness. We can't ignore their influence." "Well, first let's have a look at it," Bianchi said, finishing his vermouth. Do you have it with you? Of course. Well, let's see it. Poor Bianchi. It was obvious that he was dying for an invitation himself, and just as obvious from his slurred, uncultivated English and his skin acne that he would never receive one. Perkins took the envelope from his note case and extracted the stiff, silver-edged card, which he lay face up on the table. "It's engraved," he pointed out. "They always are," Bianchi said, putting on his shell-rimmed reading glasses. "But that doesn't prove a thing. They aren't the real article without the watermark." He held the envelope up against the table lamp, hoping, Perkins imagined, that the whole thing would prove fraudulent. "It's there," he admitted. "By God, it's there." And Perkins detected a note of grudging respect in his voice as he pointed out the two lines rampant in the neatly quartered shield. "It's the real McCoy, and no mistake." "But what do I do now?" Perkin asked with a hint of irritation. "First, let's see the details." Bianchi studied the engraved Old English script. "The pleasure of your company at the Hunt is requested on August 16th of this year. RSVP. Appropriate attire observed." "The OB," he explained, "is for obligatory." "I know that." "Well, the problem is," Perkins said in an unnecessarily loud voice, "that I have no intention of going." He was aware that Bianchi was staring at him incredulously, but this merely strengthened his own stubbornness. "It's an imposition. I don't know them, and it happens I have other plans for the 16th." All right," Bianchi said soothingly. "No need to shout. I can hear you perfectly well." With a flush of embarrassment, Perkins looked about the restaurant and caught the reproving gaze of the waiters. Obviously, he had become emotionally involved in this predicament to the extent of losing control. He hastily reinserted the invitation in its envelope and returned it to his note case. Bianchi had arisen and was folding his napkin. "Do as you like," he said, "but I know a dozen men around town who would give their right arm for that invitation." "But I don't hunt." "You can always learn," Bianchi said coldly, and signaling for the waiter, paid his bill and left. Meanwhile, word of the invitation had apparently got around the agency, for Perkins noticed that he was treated with new interest and concern. Miss Nethersole, the senior librarian, accosted him by the water cooler in deep, thrush-like tones. "I'm so thrilled for you, Mr. Perkins. There's no one else in the whole office who deserves it more." "That's very sweet of you," he answered, attempting to hide his embarrassment by bending over the tap. "But the truth is, I'm not going."
"Not going?"
The rich, pear-shaped tones, the product of innumerable diction lessons, broke into a cascade of rippling laughter.
"How can you say that with a straight face? Have you seen the rotogravure section?"
"No," Perkins said shortly.
"It's all there. The guests, the caterers, even a map of the course. I should give anything to be invited."
"No doubt you would," Perkins thought, looking at her square, masculine, breastless figure. "It's just the sort of sport which would entertain you." But aloud, he merely said, "I have other commitments," and went back to his desk. After lunch, he found the rotogravure section stuck under the blotter on his desk. Aware that every eye in the office was secretly on him, he did not dare unfold it, but stuck it into his coat pocket. And only later, after he had arisen casually and strolled down the long rows of desks to the men's room, did he, in the privacy of a locked cubicle, and with trembling hands, spread it out on his knees. Miss Nethersole had been right. The guest list was truly staggering. It filled three columns in 6-point type. Titles gleamed like diamonds in the newsprint. There were generals, statesmen, manufacturers, and university presidents, editors of great magazines, movie queens and polar explorers, broadcasters, regents, prize-winning novelists. But Perkins could not begin to digest the list. His eyes ferreted among the jumbled syllables, and at last, with a little catch of delight, he came upon the one he had unconsciously sought. Mr. Fred Perkins. That was all. No identification. No LLD or President, United, etc. Corporation. He read his own name over 4 times, and then neatly folded the paper and put it back into his pocket.
Well, he said with a thin-lipped smile, I'm not going, and that's that. But apparently Emily, too, had seen the paper. The phone has been ringing all day, she informed him as soon as he entered the house, and deposited his briefcase on the cane-bottom chair by the TV set. Of course, everyone is furiously envy, but they don't dare admit it, so I've been receiving nothing but congratulations. She helped him off with his coat. Come into the dining room, she said mysteriously. I have a little surprise for you. The telephone rang. No, wait. You mustn't go in without me. It will only be a minute. He stood uneasily, shifting from one foot to the other, until she returned. It was the Corrigans, she announced. Beth wants us to come to a little dinner party on the 17th. Naturally, she added, the date isn't accidental. They expect to pump you for all the details before anyone else in the subdivision hears about it. Now, come on. And like a happy child, on Christmas morning she took his hand and led him into the dining room. Perkins followed her with mumbled protestations. Isn't it gorgeous? They are spread out on the mahogany table, not yet fully paid for, were a pair of tan whipcord breeches, a Tattersall vest, and a bright pink coat with brass buttons. In the center of the table, where the floral piece usually stood, was a gleaming pair of boots. And here's the stock, she said, waving a bright bit of yellow silk under his eyes. You can wear one of my stick pins, the one with the onyx and the jade setting, I think would be best. And I've ordered a riding crop with a silver handle. It's to be delivered tomorrow. You're taking a great deal for granted, Perkins said. He picked up the boots and felt the soft, pliable wax leather. They must be very expensive. Where did you get the money for them? Emily laughed. They're on time, silly. We have 12 months to pay. I'll look ridiculous in that coat. No, you won't. You're a very handsome man, and I've always said you'd cut a fine figure anywhere. Well, said Perkins hesitantly, I suppose we can send them back if I decide not to go. After dinner, Bianchi drove by in his old Studebaker, and obviously in a bit fuzzy from too many cocktails. Emily opened a door for him. Fred is in the bedroom, trying on his new hunting outfit, she said. He'll be out in a moment. Who is it? Perkins shouted, and when she answered, he hastily took off the pink coat, which was a bit tight under the arms anyway, and slipped on his smoking jacket. He remembered the scene in the restaurant and felt ashamed to let Bianchi see that his resolution was wavering. Look, Fred, Bianchi said when they were seated in the living room over their old fashions, I hope you finally changed your mind about... He glanced at Emily to see how much she knew of the invitation. Go ahead, I've told her everything, Perkins said. Well, you can certainly decline if you feel strongly about it, said Bianchi in his best legal manner, but I don't advise it. If they get... Once the idea you're snubbing them, they can make things pretty unpleasant for you, and in more ways than one. But this is ridiculous, Emily interrupted. He's not going to decline, are you, darling? Well, Perkins said. She caught the indecision in his voice and went on vehemently. This is the first social recognition you've ever had, Fred. You can't think of declining. Think what it will mean for the children. In a few years, they'll be ready for college. And you know what that means. And do you seriously plan to remain in this house for the rest of your life? There's nothing wrong with this house, Perkins said defensively, reflecting that the house was not yet paid for, but already Emily was finding fault with it. Suppose the invitation was a mistake. Emily continued. I'm not saying that it was, but suppose it just for a minute. Is that any the less a reason why you shouldn't accept? But I don't like hunting, Perkins interjected weakly, and I'll look ridiculous on a horse. No more ridiculous than 90% of the other guests. Do you suppose Senator Gorman will exactly look like a center? And what about your boss, Mr. Henderson? He's certainly no polo player. Is he going? Perkins asked in surprise. He certainly is. If you had paid the slightest attention to the guest list, you would have noticed it. All right, Perkins said. Then I'll go. I think that's the wisest course, said Bianchi with a slightly blurry attempt at the judicial manner. He wrote his acceptance that evening in pen and ink on a plain stiff card with untinted edges. It's all right for them to use silvered edges, Emily pointed out, but they're apt to think it shows too much swank if you do. She telephoned a messenger service, explaining, "It's not the sort of thing you deliver my mail." And the next morning, a uniformed messenger dropped his acceptance off at the gatekeeper lodge. The ensuing week passed swiftly. Emily fitted the pink coat and the tan breeches, marked them with chalk, and sent them out for alterations. The yellow stock, she decided, would not do after all. A bit too flashy, she observed. So it was replaced by one in conservative cream. The alteration necessitated a change in stick pin and cufflinks to simple ones of hammered silver, which she selected in the village. The expense was ruinous, but she overrode his objection. "So much depends upon you making a good impression. And after all, if it goes well, you'll be invited again and can always use the same clothes. And the cufflinks will be nice for the dinner jacket," she added as an afterthought. At the agency, he found that he basked in a new glow of respect. On Monday, Mr. Presby, the office manager, suggested that he might be more comfortable at a desk nearer the window. "Of course, with air conditioning, it doesn't make as much difference as it did in the old days. But still, there's a bit of a view, and it helps break the monotony." Perkins thanked him for his thoughtfulness. "Not at all," Presby answered. "It's a small way of showing it, but we appreciate your services here, Mr. Perkins." And on Friday afternoon, Henderson himself, the agency chief, reputedly high in the councils of Intercontinental Guarantee and Trust, stopped by his desk on his way home. Since in a dozen years he had received scarcely a nod from Henderson, Perkins was understandably elated. "I understand we'll be seeing each other tomorrow," Henderson said, resting one buttock momentarily in the corner of Perkins' desk. "Looks like it," Perkins said noncommittally. "I damn well hope they serve whiskey," Henderson said. "I suppose hot punch is strictly in the old hunting tradition, but it gives me gas." "I think I'll take a flask of my own," said Perkins, as if it were his long-standing habit at hunts. "Good idea," Henderson said, getting up. And as he left the office, he called back over his shoulder, "Save a nip for me, Fred." After dinner that evening, Emily put the children to bed, and the two of them then strolled to the edge of Marine Gardens and gazed across the open fields towards the big house behind their iron grill. Even from the distance, they could see signs of bustle and activity. The driveway under the elms seemed full of long black limousines, and on the spreading lawns they could make out the caterer's assistants setting up green tables for the narrow breakfast, as they watched an exercise boy on a chestnut mare trotted by outside the fence, leading a string of some 40 sleek brown and black horses towards the distant stables. "The weather will be gorgeous," Emily said as they turned back. "There's just a hint of autumn in the air already." Perkins did not answer her. He was lost in his own reflections. He had not wanted to go. Part of him still did not want to go. He realized that he was trembling with nervous apprehension. But, of course, that might have been expected. The venture into new surroundings, the fear of failure, of committing some social gaffe, of not living up to what they must certainly expect of him. These were causes enough for his trembling hands and the uneven palpitations of his heart. "Let's go to bed early," Emily said. "You'll need a good night's sleep." Perkins nodded, and they went into their house. But despite the obvious necessity, Perkins slept very little that night. He tossed about, envisaging every conceivable social humiliation until his wife at last complained. "You kick and turn so that I can't get a bit of sleep," and took her pillows and a blanket and went into the children's room. He had set the alarm for 6, and early start was called for, but it was long before that when he was awakened. "Perkins, Fred Perkins." He sat upright in bed. "Yes?" It was light, but the sun had not yet risen. There were two men standing in his bedroom. The taller of them, he who had just shaken his shoulder, was dressed in a black leather coat and wore a cap divided into pie-shaped slices of yellow and red. "Come on, get up," the man said. "Hurry along with it," added the second man, shorter and older, but dressed also in leather. "What is it?" Perkins asked. He was fully awake now, and the adrenaline charged his heart so that it pumped with a terrible urgency. "Get out of bed," said the larger man, and seizing the covers with one hand, jerked them back. As he did so, Perkins saw the two lions rampant and the quartered shield stamped in gilt on the breast of his leather coat. Trembling and naked except for his shorts, he rose from his bed into the cool, crisp morning.
"What is it?" he repeated senselessly.
"The hunt, the hunt!"
"It's for the hunt," said the older man.
"Then let me get my clothes," Perkins stammered, and moved towards the dresser, where in the dim light he could see the splendid pink coat and whipcord breeches spread out awaiting his limbs. But as he turned, he was struck a sharp blow by the short, tapered club which he had unobserved in the large man's hand.
"You won't be needing them," his attacker laughed, and out of the corner of his eye Perkins saw the older man pick up the pink coat and, holding it by the tails, rip it up the center.
"Look here," he began, but before he could finish, the heavy man in black leather twisted his arm sharply behind his back and pushed him out of the French doors into the cold, clear, sunless air. Behind him he caught a glimpse of Emily, in night clothes, appearing suddenly in the door, heard her terrified scream and the tinkle of glass from one of the panes, which broke as a short man slammed the door shut. He broke loose and ran in a frenzy across the lawn, but the two gamekeepers were soon upon with him. They seized him under the armpits and propelled him across the street to the point where Marine Gardens ended and the open country began. There they threw him onto the stubbled ground, and the short one drew out a whip.
"Now run, you son of a bitch, run!" screamed the large man.
Perkins felt the sharp agony of the whip across his bare back. He stumbled to his feet and began to lope across the open fields. The grass cut his bare feet. Sweat poured down his naked chest, and his mouth was filled with incoherent syllables of protest and outrage. But he ran, he ran, he ran. For already across the rich, summery fields, he heard the hounds baying, and the clear alto note of the huntsman's horn.